Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise, your host. On today's pod, I have a very, very, very fun time speaking with Jill Zamorski and Shakira Jones. These ladies are the hosts of the other SOM TV podcast on the SOM TV podcast network, Glass for Every Palate and Reading and Drinking. And we are going to talk about what to drink with your Thanksgiving meal. We are also going to go through what is on our individual tables. And it's really interesting to hear what people have at their different meals, besides fighting with family and alcohol, which are essential. Okay, before we get to that, I just want to tell all of you, the holidays, they are coming. They're coming very fast. And we're in this COVID bubble, and we're all sort of trying to stay at home, but we're not realizing time is moving quickly. You need gifts. SOM TV is the perfect gift for the food and wine lover. We have insane stuff coming. Things about food, things about wine, new feature films, new shows. For $49.99, you can give SOM TV for an entire year to the person you love and the person you drink with. SOMTV.com. Thank you, everybody who is a subscriber. Without further ado, Jill and Shakira. I'm incredibly honored to have two of the most talented wine minds that I know on the podcast today to talk about Thanksgiving. I just want to forewarn everybody listening that this may go off the rails. And if it does, I hope it's not my fault. Okay, so Thanksgiving is coming very soon. I think some of you will have the advantage that you have an excuse to get away from your family because of a pandemic. Others of you will have to be with your family. Regardless, you need to drink. It doesn't really matter. So Jill Zamorski and Shakira Jones, two of my favorites, and the bedrock of the SOM TV podcast network. How are you, ladies?
Hey.
Are we going to behave ourselves today?
We're going to totally attempt to.
Okay, good.
Swear. Promise.
Promise, yes. Oh, God. All right. So we're talking about Thanksgiving. This is like this is always like this perennial thing. Everybody's like, what do we drink with Thanksgiving? What do we pair? And I think we need to come up with something original on this podcast, right?
Yeah.
Agreed. Do we have anything original? Yes?
Yeah. Yeah, it depends on what you're eating. No one's Thanksgiving tables alike anymore.
Let's talk about our tables. Right. What is at your Thanksgiving table? Jill, you're from Virginia originally. Mm-hmm. Shakira, you're from, Belize mm-hmm. and New York City. Mm-hmm. What is on your tables for this holiday?
Well, my family always does very traditional. It's probably my favorite and my dad's favorite meal of the year. So my mom is an excellent cook. So we do the very classic turkey with stuffing. Sometimes there's stuffing and dressing, inside or outside. Really good mashed potatoes and gravy. And then my not so secret shame, I think it's enjoyed by people all over the world, is that there are usually two kinds of cranberry on the table. My mom likes to make a nice cranberry relish, but my sister and my dad and I have a secret love for the cranberry, Ocean Spray cranberry jelly that comes out of the can and you slice it. Oh yeah.
I'm
yeah.
I'm in.
I have zero shame about this. And the other thing, because when I was a kid, I used to be a really picky eater, and I've clearly seen the light since then. But the other thing that is usually on our, almost always, is canned peas, specifically Lesueur peas. And I know that is a sacrilege. I'm just saying, I don't know how it became a thing. I mean, I don't know. My grandparents were, in that age, canned foods really became a thing. And so maybe my parents grew up with that. But even though there's all the fresh, delicious stuff, we'll have fresh green beans and things like that, but they're the canned cranberry dressing and the Lesueur peas do always actually make it onto our Thanksgiving table. Sometimes there's corn, sometimes there's homemade bread, and there is typically pumpkin pie because it is, of all pies, one of the best that is breakfast the day after Thanksgiving, which is very important.
Hell yes.
Okay.
Leftover pie for breakfast. So we're pretty traditional.
Relatively standard. I mean, with the peas, do you guys just heat them up or do you put butter on them? I mean, I don't understand.
No, it's this is what I'm saying. Everybody has, they do whatever they do, but I think it's the only time I eat canned peas is maybe once a year. And you just open the can and you put it in a little saucepan and you just heat them up. I mean, they're kind of mushy and they're not bright green, which is why a green bean, an haricot vert or something would be a nice, bit of texture and color, but it's just a thing. Apparently, that's one of the few things my sister and I would eat vegetable-wise when we were little kids and very picky. And so it's just become a thing.
I will say, she'd be very happy.
the cranberry in the can. One of the other great joys of Thanksgiving, aside from pie for breakfast the day after, is the days after Thanksgiving leftover sandwich. And the cranberry in the can, you can actually slice that really thin and you can like incorporate that very easily into your sandwich. And so we're thinking ahead, I think, with this dinner. There's like
the cranberry on the turkey sandwich is literally like one of the greatest things ever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, Shakira, what's on your table?
Our table is a complicated history of my family's migration to America. So first off, I'm from a really, really big family. Thanksgiving is our favorite holiday. My maternal grandmother died 4 days before Thanksgiving when I was 22. And there was this big family thing about whether or not we'd have Thanksgiving because everyone's mourning. And I decided then that I was going to cook all of it. And no one at the time in my family realized how much I had learned from my grandmother and my knack for cooking. And ever since then, I've cooked all Thanksgiving dinner. I run a tight ship in my kitchen, but we normally have a combination of our traditional foods and a lot of American classics. So we always have mac and cheese. We always have like some braised collard greens. We always have our version of cornbread, which is really more of like a corn pudding because it's not cakey or bready, but it's not creamed corn either. It's kind of like this, almost like the consistency of a lemon bar. And then I normally do some other vegetable. Like now my family's hooked on my Brussels sprouts with balsamic and bacon. So I put that on there.
Oh,
and
love
then
this.
There's yams or sweet potatoes, whichever one you call them. And then there's all of the Caribbean stuff. So we always have braised oxtail, rice and peas, plantain, curry goat, and roast pork. And a turkey.
Curry goat. And oh my God. Wow. All right, wait. So people who don't know, which I hope everybody does know, you're from Belize.
I'm from
your
Belize.
Family is.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
we grew up
on
here.
The Caribbean.
It's an amazing country in Central America that has influences from everything it's around. So we have a lot of Latin influence, but culturally it's very much Caribbean. It was a British colony. And so we have that. So our Thanksgiving tables, like you can't actually eat at the table. Like there's a table where all the food is, and then you get your food and then you go somewhere else and you sit and eat it.
I love this. Your table your table is like the most complicated thing because you just mixed, well, first of all, I think goat is the most underrated red meat
it's
in existence.
So
it's incredible. And it's from what I've read, it is the most, what is it? The most widely eaten red meat in the world.
Except in America, it's still an exotic thing. And it's
Americans just think that they are the whole world and they're not.
I'm like, goat's so good. It's tender. Yeah. If you like beef stew or you like pot roast, you'd love goat because it's the same consistency. And if you cook it right, there should be more gaminess. Yes, you have to curry it.
But curry.
You
so this is
going to
make some really interesting wine pairings at your table because you've got traditional with this.
Yep. But there's a wine pairing for all of it. And my family, like in the last 4 years, they're now expecting it. And then for desserts, we do Belize very much. I feel like it's one of the national desserts, is lemon meringue pie. And we do a caramel cake where basically it's a yellow cake. And then you boil a can of condensed milk until it turns into caramel. And then you put maraschino cherries after you've frosted the cake with this can of caramel. It's delicious. And my mom makes really, 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 really good milk cake. It's so good.
I don't think anybody who has any familiarity with you doubts that your mother is an incredible cook.
She is an amazing cook. She is. I'm not a baker. She's a baker.
Man, we need to get a camera crew at your house for this. I think that's...
I mean, tangentially. This sucks because I'm going to be depressed because, you know, normally it's a 20, 30 person affair. And this year it's just like us. But
well, I'm here to step in and just erase all the culture you just heard. I'm from Ohio and we make a pretty traditional situation. We have turkey. We always have a ham because there are people who want ham too. We always have this weird thing called carrot souffle, which comes from my wife's side of the family, which is like a spongy, buttery, sweet carrot. Like, I'm trying to figure out how I would even classify this.
It's
delicious.
That sounds good.
Oh, it's phenomenal, but it is also has to be the most unhealthy thing that has ever been made in the history of the world. I would say turnips and rutabagas have always been on our Thanksgiving table as a, you know, my mother loves turnip, loves rutabagas, and like searches them out the time of year. What else? We always have all sorts of different scalloped potatoes and, you know, I like the mac and cheese thing. I need to work that in. That's a really good call, by the way, Jill.
You need it.
Was it Jill that had mac and cheese?
It's Shakira. Yeah. I love mac and cheese. It's just not something that we typically have at Thanksgiving, but a lot of people do in the United States. And so it's super classic. I think it just depends on your family.
I love it. I know a few friends of mine who are going to do this year, they're going to do like fried chicken, like Nashville fried chicken instead of turkey. And that is something that I would like to work in. But if you think of, you know, we have like, we do like spinach and salads and, you know, the normal thing, but I think
Thanksgiving's healthy.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not. Don't worry. It's like a vessel for mayonnaise basically. But like, if you think of all of the different things we just mentioned, I think that personifies how incredibly difficult it is to find the right group of wines to drink. Now, there's two ways to look at this, right? I mean, you have to drink to be around the people you have to eat with, but you also want to try to drink the right stuff. So how do we begin a conversation of pairing? We have Jill, who has worked extensively in, you know, a number of fields, pairing food and wine. And we have Shakira. You've done it all. You've done, you know, the wine shop and as a collector and as a wine writer and everything. How do we start? How do we even begin this conversation?
I challenge us to go with what's fatty and what isn't, what's rich and what isn't, what's bitter. And then if anything is spicy, I think I'm probably the only one with a spicy table. And go.
That's too bad.
What's the preparation of the turkey? The last 3 years, we've gotten into this fried turkey thing, and it's amazing. If you haven't had it yet, fried turkey. I don't actually like turkey, but I love fried turkey. So fried turkey and a good German Riesling is really, really good. And I normally season and spice the turkey with like jerk spices. So I like something with a little bit of residual sugar on it. So like my family's become obsessed now with Peter Lauer Barrel X. And that little bit of sugar kind of tempers the heat, but like brings out everything else and it's delicious. So that is me laying down the gauntlet. I'm going to go fried turkey and German Riesling.
Yes, I love this. I love this so much. It's my pick too for turkey. Turkey's that one thing that everybody goes, you know, is it Pinot? Is it this? Is it that? And yeah, I'm going Riesling too, for sure. 100%, not even a question. Little tiny bit of sugar. I mean, even if it's a dry Riesling, it still works.
Yeah.
I mean, but why fried? Why did you call out fried for Riesling versus in the oven?
Because I think that people have two ideas about Riesling. They either completely dismiss it because they think that all Riesling is sweet, which just isn't true, or they had a really like acid-ripping Riesling before their palate had really evolved to liking that or understanding how that goes with food. And so they were turned off completely. But I think that the acidity in it makes it really, really complimentary to like things that are fried, or a little bit of sugar in it makes it really complimentary to things that are spicy. And so I think that if you love or hate Riesling, food is probably the best way to make a convert and to help people better understand that there's a wide range of styles of German Riesling, of Riesling period, and that it's really, really versatile and can go with a lot.
Jill, would you say, I'm curious your opinion about Riesling as like an affordability type thing.
Riesling is crazy affordable. The thing about Riesling that makes it so, particularly German Riesling, is that it's a really northerly location and has a really long growing season, and you accumulate like this lots and lots of flavors throughout that process as the grapes ripen. And you could make, and I think there are vineyards that have done this. You can make every style of Riesling from the same plot if the year is right in terms of ripeness and residual sugar. So that alone, I think, is a testament to just how versatile this grape is. And so that means that you can have everything from like the just kind of light and fresh and kind of easy drinking styles, fruity styles, to like really like complex and age-worthy styles, to like the lusciously sweet dessert styles. So it's the price point of Riesling is as variable, I think, as the style of Riesling.
Question for you, Jill. Since we're starting with Turkey, where do you go with Turkey? Because, I mean, you have a lot of experience, and Turkey's this weird...
Turkey's neutral, right? So Turkey's right. really lean. And even... And I my mom usually roasts the turkey, but I've had fried turkey before, and you would think that it would maybe make it greasy, but it's not greasy. It's just, like, really flavorful and, like, crispy, delicious skin and stuff. But it's a really lean meat, right? And the flavor's not super piquant. Like, it's pretty... It's kind of neutral, right? And so to me, I think one of the most important things for picking wines for Thanksgiving are all the other accompaniments on your table. And so because turkey, like it is so lean. And so I would say like generally, I would stay away from like very tannic, very structured red wines because that tannic structure is a nice balance to, you know, fatty proteins. But the protein in this case is very, very lean. And heaven forbid if you overcook your turkey and it's kind of dry, then I think a very tannic, austere wine would only exacerbate that kind of unpleasant feeling in your mouth. So I think anything that's not super tannic, it does open up the doors to all kinds of like fresh, delicious red wines. I think there's a few things that we would stay away from, but I would also put heavy
like
weight.
What? And, like what? Stay away from which tannic wines? What do you mean?
Like, Cabernet. I don't know if I'd put Nebbiolo or like young Bordeaux or like young Cabernet with, I don't think I would pick any of these, but this is, you know, you can always qualify it. You've got in a normal year, you would probably have like a lot of people around the table and obviously everyone has a different opinion on everything. And so I think it's helpful to like have some, like obviously multiple bottles to appeal to multiple palates. My first choice would not be any of those like very structured, very tannic reds, just because if we're agreeing on turkey as a main protein, now Shakira's table with some goat and your table with ham, that allows for some flexibility. So that maybe wouldn't be your only red wine, but that might allow the entrance of like a more structured red. But I think of things that are just like, you know, richer whites or light bodied kind of fresh, savory reds, like Chinon, you know, or like Cabernet Franc, I think would be really fun. A lot of people like to talk about Gamay, like because Beaujolais, you know, is or it's
even
like
a good
nice
Spanish Garnacha.
If you oh my God, Spanish
high
wines
elevation,
would be perfect.
Yeah, high
yeah,
elevation
even like
Garnacha.
Rioja with like American oak and like it's just it kind of yeah. has this like sweet spice and herbaceous note. I think yep. herbaceous wines, if you think about, there's like heavy seasoning, right? And a lot of these yeah. side dishes, whether it's like thyme or sage or whatever, like salt and pepper, there's lots of seasoning, and so I think an herbaceous characteristic in your wines could be really helpful. But yeah, the only thing that I would stay far away from is like super like ripping tannins.
Agreed.
Outside of having like 10 bottles of wine at the table, I mean, since we're
nothing
since we're
wrong
starting
with that, P.S. by the way.
No, there's nothing wrong with that. You just have to have the amount of, you know, you just have to either drink them quietly when no one's looking or have enough people. The question is with like a curry goat, on the table, mm-hmm. you've really thrown things for a loop here. How do you justify curry goat with fowl? Like, so you have turkey and curry goat, and
curry
in my case,
so good
ham.
With Beaujolais. Oh, I love curry and Beaujolais.
Yes. So here's the thing. So because Thanksgiving for my family is a long meal, like I'm going to say this because I can. It's the quintessential like. It's funny, like I've gone to other people's house for Thanksgiving and like everyone sits down at 2 o'clock and you have dinner and then like a 4 o'clock football game comes on, you're good. That is not how our family Thanksgiving goes. You don't even start picking at things until around 4 or 5 o'clock. So this is a marathon of a meal. And normally like my younger like cousins and stuff will put everything on their plate at the same time and just eat a mountain of food. My dad and my aunts and stuff, like they'll normally get like an American plate and then a more traditional Caribbean plate. So they don't eat the two things together. They actually like plate one is this and plate two is that. So it's not that you have everything on the same plate, but I do find that like Spanish reds go really well. Like I've introduced a lot of my family that doesn't like red wine. Like Spanish Garnacha goes really, really well. It's super fruity. It's got a nice minerality to it that's just pleasant and enjoyable. And it brings out like goat has a natural sweetness to the meat itself, especially younger if you use young goat, which is what I normally cook with. So it actually amplifies like this natural sweetness sweetness in the meat that's delicious. And then you have these kind of sweeter accoutrements, like you still have like candied yams and all that stuff. And it works. It's good.
I'm really hungry right now. All right, so then we move on from protein. And obviously, there are people who don't eat meat, and that's fine. The question I have, once we move into like your standard kind of stuff, okay, we have, you said cornbread shakira, which I just love so much. And you move into these different sides. How do they affect wine pairings? Do they? Does it matter?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that's like this, it's like asking the same question, like in a restaurant, it's not always the protein, but it's the sauce or it's the accompaniments that you have to consider when you're deciding on a pairing. Because if you just look at like a naked protein, it might take you one place, but depending on how it's dressed, it's going to take you in an entirely different direction. And so I think about sort of this idea of like herbaceous, like wines, whether it's red wines or white wines, like, you know, in a classic stuffing or dressing. I mean, there's so many different options, like whether it's like sausage and cornbread or whether it's oyster dressing or whether it's like cubes of bread and sage and thyme. Like there's a lot of different flavors. So something that is, you know, kind of has some herbaceous and savory characters, I really like that as well. I think you got to look at your table. I think that things like root vegetables, like turnips or parsnips or sweet potatoes or yams and mushrooms are really, really tasty with like, with Pinot Noir, you know? And so that's something that can like open up a possibility for a light red that's going to work with turkey. And if you have like the classic, which I loved, which my Nana used to make, which was like the sweet potato casserole with the marshmallows on top, where something's obviously much sweeter, then maybe that takes us into the new world where there's going to be like kind of the sweeter profile of like, you know, juicy, ripe fruit and more lavish new oak as opposed to like more earthy, like burgundy style. But I think to me, it's just looking at the sides. I will say that I think the common factor in all of the reds that I think of for Thanksgiving is that they're very red fruited. And I will tie that into my very traditional cranberry accoutrement because there's always cranberry on the table. And so I think of red fruited like flavors of wines, not red wines that have like the blue or the black flavor. And, you know, a wine with a little bit of residual sugar is not going to fight with those things. I think, you know, if we're talking about like a German Riesling or like even an Alsatian wine, like a Pinot Gris or something like that with just a touch of RS, if you think about like the stuffing and the turkey itself and the gravy, it's not going to fight it up with that at all. It's not a dessert sweet style wine. It's just a little seasoning. It's a little sweetness instead of a little salt. So I think to me, the biggest important thing would be looking at all of the other things that are going to be on the table.
Sure. And I think that, you know, for a lot of, depending on where you're from, but for a lot of immigrant families, it's really the biggest contrast between cuisines is the use of spice and heat. Like I've done a roasted turkey with a jerk rub before where it's spicy, but what I found worked best with it was a really juicy zin. You know, you have these stew elements, which is really just the same thing you would do. What do you do to make a homemade like cranberry compote? You're just cooking down cranberries, right? So you're cooking down this very tart red fruit. You're adding a little bit of sugar to it. You're adding a little bit of citrus. And I think if you get the right zin, like I think a Dry Creek Valley zin, where it's not overly robust and overly fruity, I think that's a really, really good pairing in there. And when it comes to sides, I mean, I learned to make collard greens from my best friend from high school. Her grandmother is from the South and she taught me how to make it. And a common thread across the diaspora is this use of pork and salted meats in the seasoning of vegetables. And that is the place where I found that Spanish albariños or Portuguese alvarinho works very well because you have these...
Well, what a great call, Shakira.
Great, right? You've got these...
It's so not what people think normally.
No, good it's call. Not. But when you think about it, right, you've got these bitter greens that you're braising down and you're using salt to temper that bitterness and to bring out all of the brightness and the greenness in the vegetable. So if you do that with your wine, you're only amplifying it. So I found Spanish Alvarinho or Portuguese Alvarinho to work really, really well with those green sides.
I mean, I wish to God my family had that on the side.
You gotta come
I mean, like
over.
Mustard greens or collard greens or, I mean, that stuff, Christina, who I am married to and makes the films with me, she makes a New Year's Eve dinner or it's a New Year's Day, and it has a lot of that stuff in it that I can't even tell you guys how great it is. But on Thanksgiving, I never really do that stuff. You know, the collard greens, the mustard greens, man, what a good call. That's a great call, Albarino. The saltiness too, like of that white wine, just would work so well. What a good call. I think, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, you know, there's like you mentioned how like not everybody eats meat. And so, you know, we kind of took us into a discussion of the sides. And I don't know about all y'all's families, but like not everybody prefers wine. I mean, some people prefer beer or spirits or don't want to drink. And so one thing that I actually have had a lot of success with at Thanksgiving or for just like an unexpected pairing, and it's quintessentially like of the season, is some cider. And you could do like a traditional like French cider, or you could do even like a domestic cider. And I'm not talking about like, you know, the inexpensive stuff that you can like find at the convenience store, but like
traditional. The expensive stuff's not expensive. I mean, it's pretty affordable.
Yeah. And I like, you can pick your producer and you can try different types and flavors, but like apples, you know, it's a fall fruit, and you could certainly see how an apple might make its way into like lots of different dishes at Thanksgiving. And so they're typically lower in alcohol and they're refreshing and zesty. They could be a little sweet. They could be a little dry. So I always like to like make sure that there's a consideration that cider or cedar might be an interesting,
there's no question.
I need to do more ciders. That's a good call. I didn't think about that.
No, I mean, the acid and the sweetness, I mean, a cider is I think Riesling and cider go hand in hand with the fact that they have those two elements. But I mean, if you're thinking about the first Thanksgiving, and obviously we're thinking about American Thanksgiving, is that it would have been cider. That's what would have been there. There would not have been grapes. It would have been apples or fermented plums or something like that.
Yeah, some fruit wine.
I mean, I think that's a great call.
I like that. I want to try that now. You know, the other thing is sometimes when you do just do a traditional roasted turkey, the one thing that I've tried to be a champion of is like there's this idea that rosé is just a summer wine. And I disagree with that vehemently. And I think that if you get into more savory styles of rosé and Thanksgiving pairings are phenomenal. You've got acid, you've got fruit, you've got aromatics that just smell good, like it's the smell of the holiday. And so, of course, I love Domaine Tempier more than any rosé on the planet. And I also love Domaine, and those are two really savory styles of rosé that I think go really well with a nice, I mean, some people don't do chicken. Some people, I mean, don't do turkey. They've got smaller families, or they all don't like turkey. So they'll do just a simply roasted chicken. And I think that one of those savory rosés with a nice roasted chicken, Jill mentioned like a nice hearty mashed potato and all that stuff. I think that the acid and structure in those more savory styles of rosé can really stand up nicely to those as well.
Hell yeah.
Well, how do you look at dessert? So when we get into like pumpkin pie, which is pumpkin pie, pecan pie, you know, sometimes apple pie, cherry pie, any of the stuff. These are like huge pitfalls if you are actually pairing beverage.
Oh, no.
All right, give
so
it to me,
so many places
ladies
to go.
Oh, right. So first of all, when I say pecan pie, like I should qualify this by saying my preferred pecan pie is a bourbon pecan pie. And so if we're thinking about like retiring to like, you know, away from the table and like maybe having some dessert, like a little sip in bourbon would be a nice accompaniment just because those flavors are nice. But if we also want to go like, you know, very classic American several centuries ago, you could think about something like a Madeira or a port or something that like people may have, you know, some of the first wines to be shipped across the ocean, but something kind of nutty, something with a little bit of sweetness. Like there's some options out there for some fortified wines that could be really interesting. I will say, whenever I'm doing tastings for people who are like a little unfamiliar with these wines, somehow Madeira seems to be like universally more well-liked than sherry, which I don't understand. I adore sherry. But Madeira usually
Man,
is like...
sherry.
You guys are going to have to get me on the sherry boat. I'm just not there.
That's cool. It's fine. There's more sherry for us, but I think it depends on the dessert.
Hold on.
I want to get on the sherry train.
Oh, you do? I thought you were like not happy about the sherry train.
No, I want to get, I do like some cream sherry. When I was studying for Spanish Wine Scholar, that was actually, first of all, there's so much to understand about like how it's, I don't think people realize what a complex wine sherry is and all that goes into its production. But I think I got so wrapped up in trying to learn everything about the system of making it that it was lost on me how different and good they are.
Oh boy. Oh boy. I think sherry is one of the only wines in the world you could pair almost any meal all the way through every course with.
But Shakira, you're so right. I had a friend who was just taking a test with the WSET, her fortified exams with the diploma. And she was like, God, she's like, you know, sherry, she just like texted me out of the blue one night. And she's like, there are just so many styles and so many flavor profiles. I'm like, yes, it is one of the best things, you know, like it's one of the best things, but it makes it very difficult to learn. And I think it can be hard for people, but it is so versatile. But in terms of desserts and stuff, I want to, like the caramel cake that you were talking about or the lemon meringue, those sound very delicious to me. I just, myself, I would like to finish off with like a little spirit, like a little digestif, would never hurt me. And I will say there is a thing where people kind of talk about like Thanksgiving, like you kind of like, you have to eat so much. Sometimes people joke that they have to like unbutton their buttons of their pants, you know?
And like They joke? Or
that's a thing, right? That's a people very do that, right?
Thing. Absolutely.
Where you have to have your
waist-fitting clothes.
Right. You have to have your
I don't know how old you ladies are. You guys are in your early 20s, but for me, it's a real thing.
Right. So you have to have your drinking pants and your eating pants on. But you know, a little digestif is certainly a nice way to like finish things off. So I think it depends on obviously your dessert, but I open the door into fortified wines and spirits, which I know is obviously higher alcohol, so it could tip you over the edge. But I mean, most of us are at home or someone's home on Thanksgiving, so it's not like you're going anywhere. So just settle in, put your feet up.
I created unbutton your buttons.
I look forward to the Jill line of Thanksgiving pants.
Listen, Jill and I are going to design loungewear for holiday eating.
Drinking pants,
It'll be available on Tom TV, at the shop on Tom TV. You can buy it there.
We're going to get pants drunk.
Seriously, I created this dessert a couple of years ago where I made like I stewed apples down with like cloves and cinnamon and a little bit of bourbon, and I cooled that mixture down and then folded it into empanada dough and deep fried it. And then rolled it in cinnamon and sugar, right? My dad went nuts. Everyone went nuts. And they enjoyed it with some port. Now, I was a little bit mortified that everybody wanted ice. But when I tasted it. In their port, just a cube. It wasn't what I wanted them to do. But you know what? I allowed everybody to do it and they really enjoyed it.
Thanksgiving is all about compromising.
Oh, yeah.
For the family that's around you. And everybody who's a wine. Look, outside of this world, we are all snobs, whether we like it or not, even though we're not.
Yes.
In the world, we're probably, well, I know you two ladies are very approachable. I don't know. I can't speak for myself. But outside, everyone else looks at us as snobs. So you have to allow any of these things.
Yep. Everybody dumped an ice cube or two in their glass of port. But I didn't. It was eye-opening for me because they all, like just putting that ice cube in there and chilling it a little bit for them, they all started recognizing things and why the pairing worked. And so it opened up a conversation with us talking about port and, oh, I thought that this would be too sweet. And then we had this conversation about, no, actually when you're doing desserts, you want your wine to be a little bit sweeter than your dessert is. And it opened up this whole conversation with my family about a dessert and wine pairing that I never thought that I would be having. Not because they're not able to learn wine, but just because it just wasn't a thing I thought would happen. But it was really enjoyable. And of course, if you're frying things for dessert, which I mean, I love to do, how can we not talk about champagne?
Oh my God, I was going to say, how have we not?
How have we not brought champagne into this?
Well, I think about last year, I was with friends. So I did like the Friendsgiving thing. And so everybody kind of like brought something. So it was my friend Devin, like he cooked the main proteins and sides. But like people rolled up, we had everything from like a leg of jamón ibérico to like some shrimp cocktail to like all different kinds of things. It was all over the map. And one thing that was really fun is obviously there was champagne. And I will say this, I will always advocate when you have like a group of people, big bottles. And it doesn't always have to be expensive wine. Because, you know, like a magnum of Beaujolais or a magnum of Muscadet or a magnum of you know, something relatively affordable is not going to be necessarily that expensive. But you need a group of people to enjoy a larger bottle of wine. I mean, generally, I don't know.
I mean,
two people in a
us.
Magnum is not the word, like, right?
Or us together. That's
two
fine.
People in a magnum is perfect if one's not drinking
serving.
Very much. but I would say, yeah, we have not talked about champagne, which... along with rosé, I'm going to totally agree with everything Shakir said about rosé. And I put the same kind of qualifications on champagne, is that it is such a diverse category of wine that I think the uninitiated, like people who aren't as familiar with it yet are like, oh, it's expensive bubbly wine. Or like, oh, it's just pink wine. Oh, no. Like there's so much and there's such a range of style and flavor and price point that it is incredibly versatile. And yeah, big bottles, if you've got enough people...
For
two
sure.
or more.
And you'll save money. That's actually the more economical way to do it. And funny enough, I think that a lot of people don't drink like more of the Meunier-based champagnes. And I think those are really good for...
Well, yeah. I mean,
for the richness or what's the reason?
I think that there's just a different kind of fruit and Meunier punches different. And there's so much richness in all of the dishes that we've discussed. Like I think that Meunier brings the right amount of... complementary acid and fruit that maybe a Blanc de Blanc doesn't bring.
So, I totally agree. I would not do Blanc de Blanc at Thanksgiving. I would definitely do more of a Pinot Noir and Meunier. Like dominant blend. 100% agree with you.
This is so great. You too. I just love this. All right. So we're through like a very tangential, like all of the meals. Is there anything we've left out from a standpoint of like, look,
we didn't talk sauternes.
Oh, really? You're going to go sauterne?
I mean, depending on how sweet, I don't like sugar, but I think that depending on how sweet your desserts are, a good sauterne goes really, I don't like chocolate at all, but I do think that chocolate, like chocolate-based desserts, and I mean very deep, like rich chocolate that still has a bit of bitterness to it, I have had dessert pairings that I've enjoyed when it's a sauterne that's paired with like a good chocolate mousse or something like that. But I don't really like chocolate that much. But I do enjoy sauternes when they're paired well.
I mean, I'm a big fan. Sauterne, the problem with sauterne for me is this: it's not cheap. You know,
it's expensive as fuck.
Well,
it's very
expensive. You just have to, you know, visit the satellite Appalachians, you know, like have a little St. Croix du Mont, you know, and like just try something in the neighborhood. I will say I would put one other thing in the mix for Thanksgiving, and it's like a not cool. Well, it's not that it's not cool or delicious. It's that it maybe is like a not as, I don't know, people don't drink it as much. White Rhone wine, like white Rhone blends.
Okay.
Because if you think about it, like you can, depending on what it is, like, and I'm thinking like something like Crozes Hermitage or like a white Chateauneuf du Pape, like these are not always wines that are like super stylish or trendy or whatever. And they can be, you know, more full bodied. They can be a mix of like floral and herbaceous. And, you know, I think about it. I'm like, you know what? That would be like Chardonnay wouldn't be a bad thing to have at the Thanksgiving table. Chardonnay is like the most planted
Burgundy.
Grape in the world.
It's just not going to be.
It's never going to be a bad choice. Like it's always a good call. But like, it's really easy to mistake like high quality white Rhone blends for like a white Burgundy, depending on like provenance and whatnot. And
especially with the food, Jill, I think like when you're mixing,
could be
these
kind of
foods,
fun to bring in like a little dark horse into the mix, and you know, like
listen,
slip
Louis
it in there and see what
Cibra.
People think.
Louis Cibra makes a Grand Cru Alvarinho. I tell you that shit drinks like white Burgundy, and it's way under the price of what you'd pay for it. I was going to ask you guys, like, all right, let's play a real scenario where some poor guy or girl is going to their significant other's family's house for Thanksgiving for the first time, and they want to bring wine. And I think that's a really common question is like, if I'm going to somebody's house for Thanksgiving, what wine do I bring? What advice are you giving? Are you giving folks on how to pick a wine to bring to someone's dinner for
all right, Thanksgiving? I have an answer for this, and it's going to probably surprise Jason when I have my suggestion. So, one of the, not for shameless plug purposes, but one of the books I reviewed this year was a book by Alice Firing. And she's a real advocate and proponent for natural wines.
On your podcast, yeah. Reading and Drinking.
Which is amazing, Reading and Drinking.
Which is fantastic.
She talked about how she was going to an event, and it was like a super she, like Burgundy Collectors event, like Domaine de la Romanée Conti everywhere. And she, like that was not her sandbox, right? So she didn't have anything that was like super like collectible and old and whatever. So she brought something a little eccentric and interesting. And so I think that if you are not sure and you don't know, then bring something like that's a conversation piece and kind of interesting. It also, large bottles would never hurt, but I think something interesting that like you can tell a little story about. I will say, so Saturday night, a lot of celebration, and I drank a lot of different wines with some of my friends. And one of the wines that we drank was a wine that was new to me. It was Cabernet Franc, which is my favorite red grape. And it was, the producer is Domaine Cloroche Blanche. And the wine was a special cuvée called Cuvée Pif. And it's named after the proprietor's dog. And like just little things like that, you know, like funny, like cool stories. Like if you know that they have a dog, or like, you know, Agropar Cuvée Venus, like it's named after a horse. Like funny little stories, like the horse that plowed the vineyards. Like if there's like a cool story that you can tell about the wine, even if it's not super fancy and like showy, I think that that is very endearing, and it's a good conversation starter, especially if you don't know the people. So I would vote for like a cool story.
That's
wine.
That's a cool way to walk it to like also like take the tension out of walking into a wine shop, right? Of like, you're not really a wine person, so you don't know what to ask for. But imagine just walking in and going, I want a bottle with a cool story.
Which that's good. Would you not make someone's day if you went into a store and you're like, I want the cool story wine, not the like... You know,
meanwhile,
whatever
the proper wine geek in the shop should be like, holy shit.
Dying.
This
literally
is my
dying.
Moment. This is my moment.
And like, also, that person could take that story and make it their own. Like, there's no shame in that game.
Oh, yeah. Like, I'd tell you a story about anything. that's
funny. How do you two feel about Viognier as a turkey wine?
I don't like that grape at all.
I have a love-hate relationship with that grape, and mostly it's hate. I have had a few good examples.
Oh my God. I did not expect this.
It is
well,
a
there's
whale.
Just a there's a it's it can be a hard grape to like, right? Like it has attributes that in other wines I love, but altogether
I don't
sometimes
love it.
It just makes me unhappy. You know, like it's a little bitter, but it's low in acid and high in alcohol, and it can like be a lot. Like it's just, it's so, you know.
It's a scatterbrain for me.
No, it's definitely
a very but there
high
are some very,
it's a high alcohol wine.
Well,
sure.
And there are some good examples of it for
but
sure, but
expensive.
There's also some like, yes. And that's
you gotta
the thing.
Spend
inexpensive
good money
Viognier
on the,
is not delicious.
It's bad. It's one of those wines where like you try to tell people like, no, you don't have to spend a lot of money to enjoy a good
okay,
wine.
Okay, can I make a suggestion?
But there's if it's Viognier...
Now, yes. First of all,
you need to actually spend some money on Viognier to get the best examples. Yeah.
That's true. I do like Viognier. I'm not talking about Condru. I'm talking about Viognier is a grape all over the place. There's a winery in Sonoma called Porter Creek, and they make one of the greatest Viogniers I've ever had.
I believe
and it's
inexpensive.
You. It's really, really good. The reason I like it is that it works with, it's a very floral wine. It kind of works with all the mess of Thanksgiving a little bit for me.
You know, but, actually, I would disagree and say like the intense florality and fruitiness of it and the lower levels of acidity actually make it harder as a food pairing wine.
So the salt, there's a weird thing with the floral thing. I agree with you 100% outside of the fact that if you have a very salty turkey and you have a lot of spices on the turkey. So you mentioned earlier.
I did say Rhone wines. So I'm not close to this. Like there could
be. No. Yeah, you're right. You did say that. You did. But I don't think you were talking about Viognier. I think you were talking about Marsan.
No, but there could be some Rhone. There could be some Viognier in the blend.
I'll take a Chenin before I put Viognier anywhere. I just think you have to. I think that that's one of. I'm serious. I think that that's one of the grapes that, one, I think I know a lot of people that genuinely just like it. and that's fine. But if I have to recommend it to somebody, I'm going to say, why do you want to buy that particular grape? And if you do, you're going to have to spend some money on it. Like, it's just, it's not one of those wines that I think
you should have.
Well,
the Porter Creek. I think Jason's going to have to convince you of this.
There we go.
I'm telling you, this is great.
For it. I'll try it. Right. It's just
so.
You know, funny story, Jason. There was always
hard
a,
for me, man.
I was a picky eater when I was a kid, and there was sort of a. I think this is not unique to
you're
like,
a picky drinker now. It seems.
Well, no. I'm a generalist, but it was really funny. Like this idea with little kids when they're picky is, you know, kind of what we were told, like take two bites and then you can say no, thank you. And so, you know what? I will say that about all wines. Like, I'm a generalist. I actually do really like most wines, like most varieties and stuff. So I would definitely try anything. And then if I don't like it, you know, I won't have more than one glass for sure. But
yeah,
I'm not knocking Viognier. It's just, it's a little harder to love sometimes.
Yeah, I don't hate, you know what? Viognier is like, you know, everyone does it. This is not a gender thing, but everyone has like a friend that you guys are in a friend circle, and then they want to bring another friend that no one else knows, right? And that friend doesn't actually do anything wrong.
I see where you're going, and I agree.
They're not anything, but you just don't like them. They just don't fit with everything else, and you're just like,
I don't like how good this argument is. It's too good.
I feel about Viognier. Like, this person has done nothing to me. I just don't want them around.
I feel like it's gonna give the vibe that we don't like Viognier, so but we're just
Shakira. This is exactly why I love you. It's so good.
That's how I feel. I have had some examples of it, and not just Condrieu. I've had some examples of it that I like. I just think it's one of those things where I'm like, if I never had to see you again, I wouldn't feel
bad. All right, that's it. That is it. I mean, that's it. My new
wish
with you. First of all, I like Viognier, and I would be very sad if it went
away. Say it loud and proud.
All right.
It very barely exists, and only recently has it been spread around the world. I mean, if it wasn't for this little tiny place in Condrieu, it would be gone. I mean, outside of
some blenders.
No, you're
right. It should not go away. You're right.
I'm just saying I wouldn't miss it if it did.
I'm telling you.
Kind of like the state of Florida.
Because you know what? The world needs, like, there's a wine for everyone. And I'm with you, Jason. I don't think Viognier should go away. I think there need to be more and more better examples of Viognier because, well, I don't need any more competition for the wines. I heard.
I'm just laughing so hard. This is so good. Anyway,
I don't disagree.
All right. So poor Viognier. I was just trying to just help this grape out. Okay. So, and I do like it, by the way. I think it's also one of these grapes that, you know, it's hot. It's higher in alcohol, which strangely is a thing people like. You know, it is what it is. But it also cuts through things. It's not through acid. It's with the alcohol. It cuts through things. But all right, let's. What I want to talk about.
This didn't go the way you thought.
No, it's great. No.
We're still technically on the rails. I just want to point that out. We're still. True.
Are we really?
We're still.
We
on
have
the
not
rails.
Gone off the rails.
We are still this talking about wine this entire time. We're still on the rails.
Okay. Can we agree that Pinot Noir, as a accessible situation for the normal person, is a Thanksgiving wine?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay, how do we steer people towards Pinot Noirs they can afford? It's great
to
talk about.
Stay away from France.
Okay, well, that's fine. But there are like Loire Valley has some insanely affordable, like Germany has crazy Pinot Noirs
that are very good.
My question is, how do we steer people towards, here's what you should try from a Pinot standpoint, and why, I guess. I want to approach, both of you mentioned this grape over and over again, and it is a tough one from a price standpoint.
I think you need to be open, and I think we're all champions of it in our own way, and like learning the grape and not a, like learning that the grape expresses itself differently in a place, but what you should be in love with and learn is how much you like the grape. Because I love German Spätburgunder. I think it's delicious. It drinks really well, and it's way cheaper than even most like village level Burgundy. By the same token, I love white Burgundy and would drink it every day until I died if it wouldn't bankrupt me. But I think when it comes to Pinot Noir, like the way to approach it is like, well, what do you want, right? Like, I love Sonoma Pinot. I think it's delicious. I love Pinot from Santa Rita Hills. I think that drink's delicious. I think that when it comes to Pinot Noir, I think it's just kind of classically what's been put out there. Like, oh, the red wine that goes with this is this. And I think that that's not a bad benchmark to have. But I think that when you're talking about Pinot Noir to people, what are you really telling them? Like, this is a wine, this is a grape that's super complex. It gives good fruit. It gives earthiness. It's very reflective of where it's grown. It's kind of a prima donna. You can spend a lot on it. But if you don't drink a lot of it, you probably shouldn't spend a lot of it because there's a lot of good examples of it that aren't very expensive. But I think that, especially for the holidays, people fall into this trap of like, if I'm going to somebody's house, it has to be a good wine. And a good wine has to be priced at a certain point. And I don't really know the best way. I'm interested to hear what you guys think about how you turn people away from just the assumption that they can't show up at someone's house with a good wine unless it's $100.
Well, here's something I'll just jump in really fast. I mean, I think it's tough for me because I made these movies and everybody, no matter what I bring, doesn't matter the price, people go, oh my God, I need to give this respect. So I've fallen into a very lucky position, I guess. I'm sure it's like that for both of you. I mean, whatever you bring, people go, I need to try this. So we're not talking about us, right? I mean,
yeah,
we're
that's how
about-
I clean out my cellar. I'm kidding. That's a joke.
I mean, I don't think there's anything bad in your cellar, to be honest.
It's a total joke.
What would you have?
But no, I even have friends that say, like, they'll ask, like, oh, I want to take this wine over to such and such, but I want something that's good. And I'll give them like a great bottle of like 10-year-old, 15-year-old Grand Reserva Tempranillo that's like $60. And they'll like, ah, I wanted something a little nicer. I wanted to spend more. I'm like, then you don't need me. Go into any wine shop and tell them what you want to spend and then prepare to spend $50 to $75 more. You don't need me if that's what you want. But if you want wines that are good, that are really good quality wines and priced really well, you got to be open to it. So I think people need to get off of this idea that only Pinot Noir from Burgundy is good. Pinot Noir is a grape. It's grown all over the world. And it's there are good examples of it everywhere that it's like, can you think of a place that just makes shit Pinot Noir?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I would say this.
Ooh, I want to know where. I want to know where.
No, what I would say is this. I totally agree with what Shakira is saying about like the way she's talking about Pinot Noir. I would say that in addition to that, Pinot Noir, it's so easy to like, right? Like the fruit flavors are approachable and the structure, the acidity and the tannins are not off-putting. There's no like bitterness or sweetness that sometimes can be very polarizing or lightning rods for people. I would say it then becomes, because Pinot Noir is such a prima donna, because just growing more of it and growing it anywhere does not make a better wine. And because it's always going to be relatively expensive in the market because of how difficult it is to grow and produce. I would say that I think it's a great opportunity to like find tangential wines, be like, okay, I like Pinot Noir, but I don't want to spend this much money. Should I maybe investigate like some Sicilian reds or what about a lighter Greek wine? Or what about like, what other options? What about what about Austrian reds? Like what other options for light, fresh, fruity red
but
wines
a lot of
are
people-
there?
Yeah, but Jill, a lot of people don't have access to these wines. I mean, you and I have the ability.
Wine.com. I mean, I'm not plugging like large. Well, I'm not saying this is a plug, but there are ways to get these wines that actually aren't too terribly difficult if you have internet access.
Wired for Wine too ships to like, I think, except for Wine.com, I think they're like this. They have the ability to ship to a lot of places too.
And given the situation with COVID right now, like. E-retail, online purchasing of alcohol, like there are more ways to get alcohol delivered to you and into your market than ever before. So I'm not saying that like you can convince someone who only wants to drink Pinot Noir that there are other things they should drink. But if your considerations are, you know, stylistic and budgetary, then you can look outside of Pinot Noir and say, okay, what are the things that share these similar characteristics? If price point is a really big consideration for me, should I maybe try Grenache? I mean, God, it's grown everywhere. And, so you know, good. There are such elegant and delicious styles, you know, that are made of Grenache. And it's always going to be, you know, a more affordable grape. It just is.
Carrera.
Yeah, well, Grenache is one of the chameleons of wine as far as like grapes that are. I mean, I would stand on a mountain and talk about Australian Grenache, but let's figure out. Nobody actually. Maybe if COVID can reset the world, most of Thanksgiving dinners are all just delivered all at the same time. You know, you get all the courses just dropped on the table. But how do we differentiate the different courses and what we would pair definitively? I mean, just to wrap this conversation up.
I think you have to have multiple bottles open at the table and like defy the norm that you have one wine with one course and just make it a celebration, make it convivial and pop some corks and have a couple of bottles on the table. And then, you know, the easiest thing you do is give everybody two wine glasses and then you don't have to like,
oh, great idea.
Figure your stuff out. You can drink whatever you want. And you can have two glasses, one for each hand.
Yep. I introduce it right after the prayer. We're a Christian family. So that small window that I have when we go, amen, and then everyone just attacks the table, I just get in there and go, all right, these are the wines that are open. This goes with this, 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 this. Try everything. And then I step back. And you just see what people like. I mean.
Sounds scary. Sounds like people attack.
When you think about take wine out of things completely, right? Like people drink Pepsi with breakfast. People drink sweet tea with like soup.
Everything.
You know what I mean?
Like I've been to South America and the Southern United States. Yes, both of those two places.
You know what I mean? Like, so I think that it's a good idea for us to also just, like Jill said, like put the options out there and then let people tell you, because they might have an epiphany of like a pairing that worked and they don't speak wine. But when you ask them, like, what do you love about this? Like, why is this working for you? When you translate it into wine speak, you can have a moment like, shit, that does work, doesn't it? I did not think about that one. So I agree totally. Open it all. See what people like. When they like it, tell them a little bit about what it is and go from there and let them drop ice cubes in everything if that's what they want to do. Let them enjoy the meal, enjoy the wine, and enjoy their time with their family.
Yeah. One of the most intimidating things about wine is people are concerned they're going to make the wrong choice, right? And so if it's just out there on the table, you can help yourself and you remove some of the like the ceremony from it. And like, you should like this wine with this food and this is why. And just let people kind of pick and choose. People might feel empowered to maybe drink something that they wouldn't, or whatever's left in the bottle. Whatever bottle has some wine left in it and they still want to drink something, they might, you know, they might try something they might not otherwise have done. So I have a
controversial question for you too. Is it okay to hide the good wine from the people who don't understand that it's
right
good?
It is.
Yes.
You better believe it is.
I just wanted to get that clear.
My friends are going to listen to this podcast. I'm going to get a flurry of texts like, do you hide all your good wine from me? Yes, I do.
So there's decoys. You're saying decoys are okay.
Well, look, some people just don't care about what they're drinking. And that's fine. Like, that's totally fine. But some people do.
I love you too. You two are so good.
And if you care very much or you have a special bottle that you've been really looking forward to, like if you do open that and somebody is just, and people also drink it to very different
speeds.
And people
pour it to the top of their glass.
Yeah, I'm a fast drinker. Like I just, I don't know. When I drink wine, I drink it quickly. And
girl,
so
same.
For her, I like wine. And so like if you open a special bottle that you were like hoping that everyone was going to like appreciate and savor and sip on, and then, you know, your uncle at the end of the table is like super thirsty and they just guzzle it because it's there and it's liquid and it's alcohol, like that might be a little sad. So I am 100% in favor of what you said. Yep.
For sure.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask that question because it's something we've all dealt with.
But no one should be offended by it because I think that there are wines where if I had it when I first started drinking wine, it's very likely I would have hated it because I just hadn't calibrated where I am with wine yet. And so the last thing you want to do is like give somebody this super austere wine or this raging acid white wine that you adore because it's manna from heaven. And then you give it to somebody.
And it's expensive. And it's
really
expensive, right?
And then you give it to somebody and they're like, this is why I don't spend a lot of money on wine. How much was that? And then you're like, Are you fucking kidding me? What do you mean you don't like this? This is delicious. So you kind of save yourself and that person, because the truth is they don't have to like it. So why waste the wine that you love on someone that may or may not like it? Now, if they want to try it, give them a splash, but I'm not pouring you an 8-ounce Thanksgiving pour of
And that doesn't make you a wine snob. That does not.
It makes you
this
practical.
This is the most important advice from this whole podcast.
No, I think it's too, like, everybody has different palates, but, you know, people have different priorities. And I joke about this a lot with friends of mine. Like, I don't, like, I'm not some kind of collector or whatever, but I completely have no trouble spending money on wine that some of my very good friends who probably make a lot more money than I do would be like, what? What a waste of money. Why would you ever spend money on that? And our priorities are different, and that's completely fine. So if someone does, you know, if I spent money on wine that, you know, represented a sizable, you know, investment or something that was really special because of a certain place or a time or whatever, like, that means something to me. And if it means nothing to someone else, then I think that neither party would be insulted if it was consumed by the people that thought it was important, and the people who could care less drank something else. I don't think that would be offensive to anyone.
Yeah. I don't think you should ever be offensive if there's a wine I don't want to share with you.
Because unless I'm hate you, and then I'm not going to share my wine with you.
I would never let you in my front door. But
right? I wouldn't be in my house drinking wine.
Never. But I'll always have wines that I think everyone is meant to enjoy. And if I crack open a bottle of something, I'm like, no, this is something special. If you want a splash of it, take a splash of it. If you like it and you want more, I'm happy to share. If you taste it and you go, I don't like this, no problem. There are several other options here for you to enjoy, but I do not feel compelled to share. Like, I mean, what, you know, I talked about Domaine Tempier. It's not the easiest wine. It's allocated, right? I'm down to like 4 bottles of it. And one of my best friends was over on Saturday because it was her birthday, and she loves it too. So I'm like, you know, we're real friends because I'm opening this, right? Because there's tons of other rosé that isn't $50 a bottle, because $50 for a rosé is expensive.
Yeah, but even, I mean, I've seen it way more than 50 bucks.
I know. Don't talk about my secret pricing now. Then people are going to ask me.
We were gonna film with Madame Tempier before she passed away recently,
and I'm
ugh.
Rest in peace. I mean, I can't. An icon.
Beyond an icon. I mean, I just think that she is just one of the most incredible. This family, that place. I mean, Shakira, so proud to hear you call this wine out.
I adore those wines. I think I can't get enough of it. It's so good. But I'm like, I don't think you need to go out and buy that rosé to say that you're drinking that rosé. I think that you have to like that rosé to drink it. I think there are delicious, crushable rosés that are half the price of it, right? So why?
Of course, but they can't age. They can't age. And that wine can
but
age.
I don't, do you really think that?
Are we off the rails yet, Jill?
No.
Oh, no. I was going to like give you We're 5 more examples of ageable rosés. So
there's tons of them, but I don't think everybody is place where they're aging rosés. I think that people, and it's been the way rosé has been marketing, like, this is just a fun, jovial, quaffable, I love that word, you know, wine that you can just sit and enjoy and throw back with your friends, and that's fine. And I don't think anybody should feel like, because I didn't spend $50 or $75 on a bottle of rosé, that I'm drinking bad rosé. I just do want to calibrate people sometimes to think, like, rosé is not just a cheap wine. There are really, really varying styles of rosé all over the world, and they can get really complex, and they can age really, really beautifully if you know where you're drinking from. Or you can spend $20 a bottle and drink great rosé all summer. Whichever you want to do.
And this relates to Thanksgiving, because, as you said, you know, the savory rosé situation is amazing for everything from salads to meat.
You know what? Here's the challenge I want to throw out. Do a Thanksgiving dinner with only rosé wines. It could totally be done. You could do some champagne. You could do some dry savory. You could do something from the Loire. You could do like bougie Cerdon. Like, you could do anything. I think.
Yeah.
Throw that challenge out there.
Are bubbles allowed? Are bubbles allowed?
Obviously,
for sure.
Yeah, totally.
Jamie Motley makes a Mondeuse rosé that's one of the best rosés. I mean, I wish it was easier to get, but it was really small production. But that was a phenomenal one. I love bougie. I have introduced so many people to bougie Cerdon. You know, it's light, it's effervescent, it's fruity.
It's incredible. It's really great.
And it's really good with spicy ramen. It's really
It's pretty
good.
Affordable. Yep. It's pretty cheap. Affordable.
It's cheap. Under $25, no matter where you're getting it from. And really quality producers. So it's stuff like that where you can, like, you can use Thanksgiving.
Bring
as
that
an
to your in-laws' house. Bring some bougie shirt on. There you go.
We're gonna have to sort through this bougie? And put this in the description.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, who doesn't love this? Is a bougie. Like, come on. Like, default, you win Thanksgiving. Instantly.
It goes back to your story situation.
Listen, you win Thanksgiving, and you're not the Viognier of the meal.
First of all, that is out of line. You are out of line. And listen, Viognier, I just want to help this grape. It's
everybody's been at that family dinner. Your cousin, your brother.
Want everybody to email Shakira at soundtv.com that loves Viognier.
Flood my page with your
out
Viognier.
Of wine.
I will have to do a weekly wine picks of Viognier, right? But they won't be
100%
the ones that I like. But I will take, otherwise, Viognier is your cousin, brother, or somebody's new girlfriend or boyfriend that nobody actually likes, but they don't know why.
That is not fair.
That is savage.
Ancient grape. Not fair.
No,
savage.
It's true. You don't really have a problem with it. You don't know what you don't like about it. You just don't.
I mean, I
like
know
it.
What I don't like about it, but you know what?
I don't like anything.
You gotta stand
acid.
Up on your soapbox, and I applaud you for taking
that
stand.
That low acid, low alcohol funeral home perfume thing doesn't do it for me. I'm sorry.
Man, you ladies are savage is the right way to describe it.
It's not the wine for me. You are not.
This episode is brought to you by Viognier.
The Conjure Growers Association.
The grape you should try.
Oh my God, wine regions that I'm never going to get an invitation to visit. I'm never going there. I can accept that. It's all right.
Well, I think.
Or maybe they'll want me to go there and make me a convert. Let's see.
Well, this is amazing. I'm so... we need to put all of our recommendations in some form of a document for people to follow this insanity. But you two are two of the greatest minds when it comes to pairing and drinking and just being fun people. So I appreciate it so much. Thank you so much for doing this. And make sure we have these two women have two of the greatest podcasts, Reading and Drinking and A Glass for Every Palate. I just can't thank you two enough, honestly. It is really Jill and Shakira. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you both so much. This is great. I hope all of you who are with family or without family you need a drink. That's a fact. And hopefully you enjoyed this conversation. We're going to put everything in text so that you understand what we've talked about on this podcast. And give Viognier a chance, okay? Just give it a chance. It's just, I feel like these ladies are just being very harh on Viognier.
If they miss.
And Viognier is not a bad grape, okay?
It's not.
Give Viognier a chance. I'll back you up on that.
I'll give you that.
Thank you. You two are the greatest minds in wine that I know. And be safe. Go to somtv.com. Listen to these ladies' podcasts, A Glass for Every Palate, and Reading and Drinking. Thank you, everyone. Tune in next time. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I just want to take a second and say that no Viognier was harmed in this podcast. And I still think that all grapes deserve a chance. So drink whatever you want. Don't listen. Don't listen to them who hate Viognier. Don't forget to go to somtv.com. Next week, we have a great, great episode. I am speaking with the founder and CEO of Avino, an app you may have on your phone, which you use to scan wine and possibly buy wine and catalog what you drink. And this is an amazing story about how a guy from islands off of Denmark founded this app and got himself into the wine world. And the data they collect, it's like the Freakonomics of wine. And so we get into that stuff, and you're going to want to tune in. Until then, please be safe and be nice to people. The wine world and every world right now needs more kind people. So just be nice right now, please. Okay. Talk soon.